West Legal Aid Center would like to welcome you to the audio program, Whistleblowing in the Corporate World Series, Part 4, an insider guide to the SEC enforcement process. Thank you for joining our presenter. Jordan Thomas is a partner at Labaton Sucharow and chairs its whistleblower representation practice. Labaton is one of the country's premier private securities litigation firms and the first law firm in the country to establish a practice exclusively focused on protecting and advocating for SEC whistleblowers. Prior to joining Labaton, Jordan spent more than 15 years in federal law enforcement as both a trial attorney at the Department of Justice and an assistant director in the Enforcement Division of the Securities and Exchange Commission. While at the agency, Jordan played a leadership role in the development of the SEC Whistleblower Program. Currently, he is also the editor of SECWhistleblowerAdvocate.com, a website dedicated to helping responsible organizations establish a culture of integrity and courageous whistleblowers to report possible securities violations without personal or professional regrets. Please submit questions by clicking the Submit Questions button located directly under your viewer window. The program materials are located to the right of your viewer window. Thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to Jordan.
Good morning, and thank you for participating today in the fourth installment of our webinar series, Whistleblowing in the Corporate World. In our first program, the advent of the SEC Whistleblower Program, we addressed the origin and the basic mechanics of the SEC Whistleblower Program. And in the second program, the Securities Law Primer, we provide an overview of the laws that govern the securities industry. Next, in the third program, Accountants as Whistleblowers, we discuss the important role that accountants can now play in protecting investors following the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. If you missed these programs or any other part in this series, you can always view them on demand at the West Legal Aid Center. Now, to better understand the SEC enforcement process, my presentation will explore the rich heritage, unique culture, and the complex operations of the agency's National Enforcement Program from an insider's perspective. As a preliminary matter, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a former assistant director and assistant chief litigation counsel in the Division of Enforcement. For more than 8 years, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to investigate, prosecute, and supervise a wide variety of high-profile matters, such as those involving Enron, Fannie Mae, UBS, and Citigroup. During my tenure, I'm proud to have had a leadership role in the development of the SEC Whistleblower Program. In recent years, I know it has become popular to criticize the SEC. Unfortunately, the missteps of a few have sometimes overshadowed the significant accomplishments of the many smart and dedicated professionals at the SEC who quietly protect investors every day. In this presentation, you will learn more about the great and often unheralded work that the SEC does. Let's begin by exploring what led to the establishment of the SEC. Let's begin on slide 3. Following the stock market crash of 1929 and the ensuing depression, Congress enacted two landmark pieces of legislation, the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. These statutes were designed to restore investor confidence in the capital markets by providing investors and the market with more reliable information and clear rules of honest dealing. The Securities and Exchange Commission was established to enforce these and future securities laws. The SEC is an independent federal agency and the primary overseer and regulator of the U.S. securities markets. As the primary federal agency responsible for the securities industry in the United States, the SEC has broad rulemaking powers and the authority to investigate and enforce violations of the federal securities laws. Next slide. The SEC's primary mission is to protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation. To this end, the Commission is empowered with broad authority over virtually all aspects of the securities industry. Next slide. So how does the SEC do this? In furtherance of its mission, the SEC has the responsibility and authority to interpret the federal securities laws, issue new rules and amend existing rules, oversee the inspection of securities firms, brokers, investment advisors, and rating agencies, oversee private regulatory organizations in the securities, accounting, and auditing fields, and coordinate U.S. securities regulation with federal, state, and foreign authorities. Next slide. Now, let's look at the statutes that the SEC derives its authority from and that it enforces. The key securities statutes in the United States are the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, the Trust and Indenture Act of 1939, the Investment Company Act of 1940, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, and the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. Next slide. The Securities Act of 1933 regulates the public issuance of securities. Its two main objectives are to ensure that investors received adequate financial and other important information about securities being offered to the public, and to ensure that the information is accurate and reliable. Key provisions of the statute include requiring the registration of securities to be issued, securities must be sold pursuant to a prospectus, and creates liability for false and misleading statements in registration statements or prospectuses. Next slide. The Securities and Exchange Act of 1934 established the Securities and Exchange Commission. It regulates the activities of public companies. Specifically, it imposes the requirement of periodic corporate reporting and regulates proxy solicitation and tender offers. It mandates registration of broker-dealers. It regulates the purchase and sale of securities in the secondary markets. And like the Securities Act of 1933, it prohibits false and deceptive conduct in connection with securities transactions. Next slide. The Trust and Indenture Act of 1939. This act requires a trust indenture for the sale of bonds and other debt securities worth over $5 million. It also requires the appointment of a trustee to all bond issuers. Next slide. The Investment Company Act of 1940. This regulates investment companies, entities that are engaged primarily in the business of investing, reinvesting, or trading in securities, or are engaged in that business, and more than 40% of their assets consist of investment securities. A good example of an investment company would be a mutual fund. This act requires every investment company to register with the SEC. Registered investment companies must file annual reports with the commission, disclosing information about their financial condition and investment policies to investors. It also imposes certain restrictions on trading activities of investment companies. Next slide. The Investment Advisors Act of 1940. It requires firms or individuals who advise others about securities investments to register with the SEC. It applies only to advisors that manage at least $25 million in assets or that advise a registered investment company. It prohibits fraudulent or deceptive conduct by investment advisors in connection with their services. Next slide. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. This act created the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. It requires that all audited financial statements be certified as accurate by the corporation's senior management, and it requires companies to establish internal control and reporting systems to uncover fraud in financial reporting. It created the Financial Stability Oversight Council. Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010 on slide 13 created the Financial Stability Oversight Council. It requires hedge funds managing over $100 million in assets as investment advisors to register with the SEC. It also requires the SEC to enact a whistleblower program to pay whistleblower awards to individuals who provide information about possible securities violations to the SEC. Next slide. We're on slide 14. This is the organizational chart for the SEC. The SEC is a bipartisan five-member commission consisting of a chairman and four commissioners, all of whom are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. The chairman serves as the commission's chief executive officer. The commission may not have more than three commissioners from the same political party, and the commissioners serve for staggered five-year terms. The SEC is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and has 11 regional offices throughout the country. The regional offices are responsible for investigating and prosecuting potential violations of the federal securities laws. These offices also have examination staff who conduct inspections and exams of regulated individuals and entities such as investment advisors, investment companies, and broker-dealers. In fiscal year 2011, the SEC employed more than 3,800 people and had approximately $1.6 billion budget. This figure does not include the more than $450 million in the Replenishing Investor Protection Fund established by the Dodd-Frank Act, from which eligible whistleblowers will be paid monetary awards under the SEC Whistleblower Program. Next slide. The SEC is organized into five major divisions: the Division of Enforcement, the Division of Corporate Finance, the Division of Trading and Markets, the Division of Investment Management, and the Division of Risk, Strategy, and Financial Innovation. Let's take a look, closer look at each division. The Division of Enforcement. This division investigates and prosecutes violations of federal securities laws in federal courts and administrative proceedings on behalf of the Commission. It often works in close coordination with other interested federal and self-regulatory organizations. The division also recommends to the Commission trading suspensions, sanctions against entities and individuals, injunctions and temporary restraining orders, and bars prohibiting participation in penny stock offerings or serving as an officer or director. This division is the largest at the SEC with more than 1,100 staff members. Next slide. The Division of Corporate Finance. This division oversees the disclosure by public companies of information required to be filed with the Commission under the securities laws. Disclosures documents reviewed include registration statements for newly offered securities, annual and quarterly reports, proxy materials, documents concerning tender offers, and filings related to mergers and acquisitions. It's important to note here that any review by corporate finance does not constitute a defense for securities violators against future prosecution if they engage in misconduct, such as making material misrepresentations or omissions. Additional division responsibilities for the Division of Corporate Finance is providing administrative interpretations of the 33 Act and the 34 Act and the Trust and Indenture Act of 1939. Recommending regulations to implement these statutes, providing guidance and counseling to registrants, prospective registrants, and the public to help them comply with these laws. And it also monitors the activities of the accounting profession, particularly the Financial Accounting Standards Board. Next slide, the Division of Trading and Markets. This division is responsible for maintaining fair, orderly, and efficient markets. It provides day-to-day oversight of the major securities markets participants, such as securities exchanges, securities firms, self-regulatory organizations, transfer agents, credit rating agencies, and the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Additional division responsibilities include operating the Commission's Financial Integrity Program for broker-dealers, reviewing and in some cases approving proposed new rules and proposed changes to existing rules submitted by the SROs, assisting the Commission in establishing rules and issuing interpretations on matters affecting the operations of the securities market, and surveilling the markets for irregularities. Next slide. The Division of Investment Management. This division oversees and regulates America's $26 trillion investment management industry. It regulates investment companies, which include mutual funds, closed-end funds, unit investment trusts, ETFs, interval funds, variable insurance products, and federally registered investment advisors. The division's additional responsibilities include assisting the Commission in interpreting laws and regulations for the public, and the SEC staff, responding to no action requests and requests for exemptions, reviewing filings from investment companies and investment advisors, and assisting the Commission in enforcement matters involving investment companies and advisors. It's worth noting here, similar to the comment made regarding the Division of Corporate Finance, that the fact that the Division of Investment Management reviews a filing does not serve as a defense for securities violators to various forms of misrepresentations and omissions. Next slide. The Division of Risk, Strategy, and Financial Innovation. This division was established in September 2009 to help identify developing risks to and trends in the financial markets. Among the functions being performed by the division are providing strategic and long-term analysis, identifying new developments in systemic risk in financial markets, providing guidance to the Commission regarding the effect of these new developments and risk on its regulatory activities, and educating SEC staff on new developments and trends. This new division has been a welcome addition to the Commission because it has been responsible for bringing numerous thought leaders and industry experts to the Commission who are primarily focused on identifying the areas where future misconduct will be occurring and developing new techniques for identifying and prosecuting current misconduct. Too often in the past, the SEC has focused most of its energies on responding to possible securities violations rather than anticipating misconduct and innovating in the manner in which it investigates its cases. Next slide. Other offices that provide vital support functions for the SEC include the Office of the General Counsel, which serves as the Chief Legal Officer of the Commission and provides independent legal analysis and advice to the Chairman, Commissioners, and Operating Divisions on all aspects of the Commission's activities. In the enforcement context, the Office of General Counsel regularly writes memoranda to the Commission on important, complex, and novel issues that may present themselves in Enforcement Division recommendations. The Office of Compliance, Inspections, and Examinations conducts examinations of registered entities and persons such as investment advisors, investment companies, broker-dealers, self-regulatory organizations, credit rating agencies, transfer agents, and clearing agencies. The mission of this office is to foster compliance with the securities laws, to detect violations of the law, and inform the Commission of developments in the regulated community. For minor deficiencies, this office will provide a deficiency letter. For more serious violations, the matter is often referred to the Enforcement Division for investigation. This office has undergone significant reorganization in the last year so that it could become more effective and efficient. The Office of International Affairs is another important office that assists the Chairman and the Commission in the development and implementation of the SEC's international regulatory and enforcement initiatives. In many ways, the professionals in this office operate like many international ambassadors for the agency. They negotiate and oversee international agreements involving regulatory cooperation and enforcement assistance. In the enforcement context, this office plays a critical role in securing potentially relevant evidence and the ill-gotten gains of securities violations that may be overseas. Lastly, but not least, the Office of the Whistleblower is responsible for administering the SEC Whistleblower Program, a program that we will discuss in greater length later in the program. This office was established following the enactment of Dodd-Frank, which was in July 2010. Next slide. To understand the SEC of today, it is important for you to learn about the enforcement challenges that the agency faced prior to the enactment of Dodd-Frank. Having worked extensively with SEC staff members from around the country, I can tell you that many of the agency's problems can be traced back to one thing, a lack of actionable intelligence. The agency has been hampered by limited self-reporting by corporations, a low percentage of high-quality tips, being complaints and referrals. This may be caused in part by potential liability for those reporting and insufficient protections and incentives. As a result, regulators were limited to being first responders to corporate misconduct. as opposed to being proactive. This also had an impact on the way the cases were developed. Cases had to be developed circumstantially, from the ground up, whereas with actionable intelligence, regulators would have been able to go directly to the area of misconduct and narrow the scope of investigations. Next slide. And then everything changed. The financial crisis devastated economies around the world. The details of the Madoff scandal became public. Congressional inquiries and related hearings exposed the limitations and failings of both corporations and law enforcement authorities. Our government and many others were called upon to save weak institutions in the financial services industry. And predictably, there was a public outcry. In short, a perfect storm of regulatory mistakes, egregious institutional risk-taking, and good old-fashioned greed and fraud paved the way for an international financial crisis of epic proportion and scandals of shocking magnitude. Next slide. In response to the crisis, governments around the world have taken different approaches to reform. In the United States, in July 2010, one of the first major initiatives taken by the SEC was to establish specialized enforcement units in five priority areas. The purpose of these specialized units is to address the unique challenges presented by new, complex, and specialized types of securities fraud. Through enhanced training and improved access to specialists, unit members obtain an increased understanding of particular markets, products, and transactions. They then use that expertise to adopt a more proactive approach to identifying conduct and practices ripe for investigation, to conduct those investigations with increased effectiveness and efficiency, and to share their expertise with the general enforcement staff. The specialized units are the asset management unit. This unit focuses on, among other things, investigations involving investment advisors, investment companies, hedge funds, and private equity funds. I'm proud to have been one of the founding assistant directors of this unit. The market abuse unit. This unit focuses on investigations involving large-scale market abuses and complex manipulation schemes by institutional traders, market professionals, and others. The structured and new products unit. This unit focuses on complex derivatives and financial products, including credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, and securitized products. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act unit. This unit focuses on violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which prohibit U.S. companies from bribing foreign officials for government contracts or other business. And lastly, the Municipal Securities and Public Pensions unit. This unit focuses on misconduct in the large municipal securities market and in connection with public pension funds, such as offering and disclosure fraud, tax or arbitrage-driven fraud, pay-to-play, and public corruption violations, public pension accounting and disclosure violations, and valuation and pricing fraud. In response to some of the lessons learned from the Madoff scandal, the division also created an Office of Market Intelligence, which is responsible for the collection, analysis, and monitoring of the tens of thousands of tips, complaints, and referrals that the SEC receives each year. The head of this office also has day-to-day supervisory responsibility for the Office of the Whistleblower. Next slide. Around the same time as the specialized units were announced, the SEC established an innovative initiative called the SEC Cooperation Program. It is an initiative designed to encourage and facilitate individuals and entities with potential civil or criminal liability to come forward and report possible securities violations. Using the same tools that have been successfully used by prosecutors in the Department of Justice for decades, tools such as cooperation agreements, deferred prosecution agreements, non-prosecution agreements, and criminal immunity requests. In plain English, the SEC now has a way to get bad guys to come in and provide assistance in its investigations and related enforcement actions, rather than having to force them out of hiding and later prosecute them. As a result, the SEC has become more effective and efficient. No longer can those with potential liability simply circle the wagons and reasonably expect to avoid being successfully prosecuted, as was often the case in the past. The program compels co-conspirators to break ranks with one another and compete for a deal from the SEC and other law enforcement authorities. Next slide. 6 months later, Dodd-Frank emerged. Among the statute's goals was to promote financial stability, protect consumers, investors, and businesses. Significantly, it also was intended to end taxpayer-funded bailouts of financial institutions. Arguably, the most revolutionary aspect of the legislation from a securities enforcement perspective was the establishment of the SEC whistleblower program. The Act required the SEC to establish a whistleblower program which offers anonymous reporting, robust employment protections, significant monetary awards. The implementing rules for the program became effective on August of 2011. Next slide. To understand the significance of this important investor protection program, it is necessary to know who can be an SEC whistleblower. An individual who alone or jointly with others provides information to the SEC relating to a possible violation of securities laws that has occurred, is ongoing, or is about to occur. Now, it's important to note, an SEC whistleblower can report on something that has occurred, is ongoing, or is about to occur. This definition is rather broad. However, whistleblowers can only be individuals, not companies. Next slide. Let's go through each of the three pillars of the SEC whistleblower program. First, anonymous reporting. In the past, too often, the fear of retaliation or social stigma has deterred some potential whistleblowers from reporting possible securities violations, and as a result, countless investors have been seriously injured. Such fear, whether real or imagined, undermined corporate compliance and integrity programs and the ability of law enforcement authorities to detect and prosecute securities violations. To correct this serious problem and encourage everyone to take a stand against wrongdoing, the SEC whistleblower program permits whistleblowers to report possible securities violations anonymously. To anonymously report a possible violation of securities laws to the SEC, a whistleblower is required to be represented by an attorney and must provide his or her counsel with a copy of the submission signed under the penalty of perjury. The attorney will verify the identity of the whistleblower before any information is submitted to the SEC, serve as an intermediary between the SEC and the whistleblower during any investigation related enforcement action, and advocate for the highest possible monetary award if the submission results in a successful enforcement action. Prior to receiving any monetary award, for eligibility, tax, and other reasons, whistleblowers must disclose their identity to the SEC. After this disclosure, since SEC investigations are confidential and non-public, the agency may only disclose the whistleblower's identity in very rare, or limited circumstances. One practical warning for potential whistleblowers: even if a whistleblower subsequently retains counsel to make an anonymous submission, the SEC may not be able to fully protect the whistleblower's identity if it has already been disclosed to them. Accordingly, the best practice is not to contact the SEC until a whistleblower has decided whether to file externally and whether to file anonymously. Next slide. Dodd-Frank also established new and more robust employment protections. Specifically, Section 922 of Dodd-Frank states, "No employer may discharge, demote, suspend, threaten, harass, directly or indirectly, or in any other manner discriminate against a whistleblower because of any lawful act done by the whistleblower, including reporting misconduct to the SEC. If retaliation does occur in violation of the law, whistleblowers may receive reinstatement with equivalent seniority, 2 times back pay with interest, legal fees, and other significant remedies." Next slide. The last major pillar of the SEC whistleblower program is the ability to receive monetary awards. Subject to the eligibility requirements of the program, the SEC will pay an award or awards of 10 to 30% of the monetary sanctions collected to one or more whistleblowers who voluntarily provide to the SEC with original information that leads to the successful enforcement by the Commission in a federal court or administrative action, in which the SEC obtains monetary sanctions totaling more than $1 million. The SEC will also pay an award based upon amounts collected in certain related actions. It should be noted that several of the enforcement actions brought by the SEC in every year have monetary sanctions in excess of $100 million. Obviously, with monetary awards up to 30% of the sanctions collected, for the first time, whistleblowers now have significant financial incentives to come forward and report possible securities violations to the SEC. Next slide. Now, let's look at the key statistics. They will help us to better understand the SEC's National Enforcement Program and its whistleblower program. More than 30,000 tips, complaints, and referrals are received by the SEC annually. Approximately 3,000 whistleblower submissions were made in the first full year of reporting. More than 2,000 active cases are going on at any one time, and there are approximately 1,100 division members. Every year, 700 to 750 enforcement actions are brought. 20% of these enforcement actions exceed the $1 million in monetary sanctions. And for each of the last 2 years, the SEC has secured approximately $3 billion in monetary sanctions. With this background, let's look at the SEC investigative process. Enforcement of the securities laws begins with an investigation, which may be initiated formally by the Commission or informally by the staff of the Division of Enforcement. Investigations vary in their size, complexity, and importance. Devoting appropriate resources to investigations that are more significant helps to ensure high-quality investigations and maximize desired program outcomes. Thus, the SEC generally seeks to conserve its relatively scarce resources by commencing an investigation only when it believes that a significant violation of the federal securities laws may have occurred. It's for this reason that I advise whistleblowers to provide as robust a whistleblower submission as possible. Information about possible violations come from many sources, including market surveillance activities, staff review of company filings made with the Commission, inspections and examinations, investors' tips and complaints, the self-regulatory organizations and other authorities' referrals, media reports, and whistleblowers. Many high-quality cases are initiated by the SEC because of a referral from an SRO. For these referrals, the Division of Enforcement's Office of Market Surveillance is the primary point of contact. If an SRO discovers potentially illegal conduct and believes that it has jurisdiction, it often will conduct its own investigation. If the SRO determines that it does not have jurisdiction or believes that the misconduct is particularly serious, it is likely to refer the potential violations to the SEC. Next slide. Not surprisingly, with over 30,000 tips, complaints, and referrals, the SEC must be very selective in the cases it takes. Accordingly, when selecting and ranking investigations, the staff considers whether the possible violations presents an opportunity to send a strong and effective message that will deter future violations. It appears egregious or extensive, involves potentially widespread and extensive harm to investors, involves regulated individuals or entities, fiduciaries or others with substantial authority or responsibility, involves newly enacted legislation or regulatory rules, occurs in connection with products, markets, transactions, or practices that pose significant risks for investors or a significantly important sector of the market, or involves a substantial number of victims. Next slide. The challenge for the SEC is not only being very selective, but effectively allocating its extremely limited resources. Since staff members are often assigned to more than one investigation at a time, and investigative priorities can rapidly change, effectively allocating resources requires flexibility and creativity. Factors considered by the staff include whether there is an urgent need to file an enforcement action, This is an example. This might be in an acid freeze case. The volume evidence that the staff must collect and review. The level of analysis required for complex data evidence. The number, location, and scheduled receipt of documentary and testimonial evidence. The travel requirements associated with the case. Timelines for preparing internal memoranda and related review. And coordination with and timing considerations of other federal or state law enforcement and regulatory organizations. Next slide. The SEC has authority from Congress to conduct investigations as it deems necessary to determine whether any person has violated, is violating, or is about to violate the federal securities laws. The agency's decision to initiate an investigation is not subject to judicial review. There are three types of investigations: matters under inquiry, and informal investigations, and formal investigations. Let's look at each. When the SEC has reason to believe that a possible securities law violation has occurred, it will often conduct a preliminary inquiry to determine whether the allegation should be examined in more detail. The case will then become a matter under inquiry. These inquiries are preliminary in nature and typically involve incomplete information. The threshold determination for opening a new MUI is quite low, because its purpose is solely to gather additional facts to help evaluate whether a more extensive investigation would be an appropriate use of the SEC's resources. MUIs automatically convert to an investigation after they've been open for 60 days. Next slide. Another type of investigation is an informal investigation. Generally, this involves a request for voluntary cooperation in providing documentary or testimonial evidence to the SEC staff. While the SEC While the subject individual or entity is under no obligation to comply with such a request, it is usually in that person or entity's interest to do so, as the SEC may look more positively on that individual or entity, and it could influence the staff's ultimate decision about whether to seek a formal order of investigation from the Commission. Once notice of an informal inquiry is received, however, the subject person or entity is required to preserve relevant documents. In fact, the destruction of relevant documents after receiving such a request could lead to charges of obstruction of justice. During this type of investigation, the staff cannot compel an individual to give testimony, nor can it require or administer oaths or affirmations if testimony is given. The last type of investigation is a formal investigation. It is initiated by a formal order of the Commission following a showing by the staff that there is a reasonable basis for believing that a violation of the federal securities laws has occurred or is ongoing. Armed with a formal order, staff members can administer oaths and affirmations, subpoena witnesses, compel the attendance of witnesses, take evidence, and require the production of documents and other materials. Significantly, formal orders are issued without notice or an opportunity to be heard by the subject of the subject of the investigation. Next slide. Perhaps one of the most common questions asked by the subject of SEC investigations and whistleblowers is how long will an SEC investigation take? In conducting investigations, the SEC must continually balance the need for complete, effective, and fair investigations with the need to file enforcement actions in as timely a manner as possible. Historically, investigations have taken 2 to 4 years to complete. Factors that tend to increase the length of investigation include, but are not limited to, complexity of the possible violations, scope of the alleged misconduct, location of the relevant evidence, coordination with other state and federal authorities, and delays caused by potential defendants and others with relevant information. In fiscal year 2011, the SEC filed 61% of its first enforcement actions within 2 years of opening a matter under inquiry. Next slide. Consistent with its expansive authority to investigate violations of the federal securities laws, the SEC has broad subpoena power. The SEC may request any information that is reasonable and potentially relevant to the investigation, including documentary evidence and witness testimony. Subpoenas can be issued anywhere in the United States, and witnesses may be compelled to appear at any designated place of hearing. Next slide. A party receiving an SEC subpoena has few options to challenge it. The party could try and move to quash the subpoena, but such motions are rarely successful. Common challenges to an SEC subpoena include claims that the subpoena is overly broad and seeks irrelevant material, that compliance with the subpoena would be unduly burdensome, or that the subpoena calls for privileged material such as attorney-client privileged information. The courts have taken an expansive view of a federal agency's, including the SEC's, subpoena power, and the SEC need only show that, one, the investigation will be conducted for a legitimate purpose, two, the inquiry may be relevant to that purpose, three, the information sought is not already within the SEC's possession, and fourth, all administrative steps required by law have been followed. Another option is that a person could refuse to comply with the subpoena. As SEC subpoenas are not self-enforcing, the Commission takes such refusals very seriously, and if the refusal persists, the Director of Enforcement has the authority to institute a subpoena enforcement action. It is during the subpoena enforcement action that a party can raise challenges to the subpoena. Next slide. Producing documentary evidence. The ability to obtain documents is critical to SEC enforcement investigations. Enforcement staff often issue subpoenas requiring the production of certain categories of documents at a specified time and place. Unwarranted delays or failure to produce relevant documents is viewed negatively by the staff. Sanctions are possible for incomplete or delayed document productions that harm the integrity of the investigative process. Next slide. Often, after the enforcement staff has received and reviewed documents that have been produced, they will request or compel with a subpoena the testimony of witnesses. Witness testimony gives the staff an opportunity to develop facts relevant to the investigation and the witness the chance to explain issues raised by the documents or other testimony. Testimony is non-public. Witnesses are allowed to have counsel present, but no one else. Federal rules of civil procedure and rules of evidence do not apply to these proceedings. The potential defendant's testimony is likely to be an important factor in the staff's decision whether to and what extent to recommend an enforcement action. Next slide. Although the SEC's authority to conduct investigations subpoena power is broad, it is subject to certain legal restraints. Commission investigation subpoena power are specifically subject to evidentiary privileges. The most common are the attorney-client privilege and the work product doctrine privilege. Privileges can be waived. Whistleblowers should never produce privileged materials to the SEC without consulting with counsel or staff in the office of the whistleblower, because such documents, if tainted, may require the change of investigative teams or other administratively difficult steps by the SEC. Next slide. The attorney-client privilege protects communications made in connection with obtaining legal advice. Any individual or entity that is asked to testify before or provide documents to the SEC may invoke the attorney-client privilege and decline to provide the Commission with privileged communications. The attorney-client privilege arises from the recognition that to obtain adequate legal representation, a client must be able to communicate honestly with his or her attorney without fear of subsequent disclosure of those communications. The attorney-client privileges protects all disclosures to the Commission of any communications made in connection with the obtaining of legal advice. The requirements for the attorney-client privilege to be applicable is that the person or entity is or has sought to become a client. the person to whom the communication was made is a member of the bar or a subordinate of such a person. The communication was for the purpose of obtaining a legal opinion or services in connection with a legal proceeding, and not for the purpose of committing a crime. And lastly, the privilege has not been waived. The voluntary disclosure of the communication by the client to a third party may result in the waiver of the attorney-client privilege. Now, communications to a corporation's attorney by an employee are generally protected under the attorney-client privilege. Next slide. The work product doctrine protects from the disclosure to the commission all documents and other materials prepared by a party or his or her attorney in anticipation of litigation. This privilege is broader than attorney-client privilege. Privilege, however, is not absolute and can be overcome if there's a substantial need for the materials, a substantial equivalent of the materials cannot be obtained without undue hardship, and the voluntary disclosure of the protected materials constitutes a waiver of the privilege. Next slide. A person or company that is subject of an SEC investigation can waive the attorney-client and work product privileges. The waiver of privileges can occur intentionally or unintentionally. The decision to voluntarily waive a privilege must be carefully considered. It is possible that a voluntary waiver to the commission could result in a general waiver of the relevant privilege in other contexts. Courts have considered this issue of limited and general waiver and are divided on the scope of a voluntary waiver and whether it constitutes a general waiver for all purposes. If you're considering waiving a privilege, it's important to consult counsel. Next slide. The unique aspect of SEC investigations is that they are confidential and non-public. The disclosure by the Commission to third parties of information obtained during an investigation is generally not permitted. The implementing rules for the SEC whistleblower program permit staff to disclose otherwise non-public information if the whistleblower signs a confidentiality agreement. Section 24C and Rule 24C1 of the Exchange Act permit the Commission to provide access to confidential and non-public information in enforcement files. Access is generally limited to government agencies, law enforcement authorities, self-regulatory agencies, and other similar parties. Authorized recipients must provide assurances to the SEC that the information will remain confidential, and this assurance is required under Dodd-Frank if the Commission is to provide information provided by whistleblowers. Information that is privileged will rarely be disclosed to other parties. Next slide. The Freedom of Information Act, a federal law that gives citizens the right to access information in the possession of the United States government. The Commission could be required to disclose information pursuant to a FOIA request, and some media outlets and whistleblowers use this as a tool to obtain information. However, there are 9 exemptions from disclosure under FOIA. A few of the most relevant exemptions include information that contains trade secrets or confidential business information, constitutes inter- or intra-agency communications, or the information was compiled for law enforcement purposes and their production would interfere with an ongoing enforcement proceeding. The last is the most common reason for the SEC not providing information to the public, are circumstances where there's an ongoing investigation. Next slide. Requesting confidential information under FOIA. A party may request confidential treatment of information provided to the Commission to prevent disclosure under FOIA. This is a very common practice by corporations when providing information to the SEC. Information may receive confidential treatment to protect personal privacy or sensitive business information. If granted, the information is protected from disclosure while the investigation remains open. The information must be segregated from other information provided to the SEC, clearly marked as confidential, and accompanied by a written request for confidential treatment specifying the information to be kept confidential. Next slide. The Privacy Act. The Privacy Act provides for notice and protection to persons for whom a federal agency requests information. The Commission must give a notice to every individual asked to provide information stating the legal authority under which the information is being requested and whether compliance is voluntary or mandatory. the purposes for which the information will be used, the routine uses which may be made of the information, and the potential consequences of not providing the information. This notice is provided to most witnesses by the SEC in what's called a Form 1662. If disclosure is made, the Commission generally must keep a record of any disclosures under the Privacy Act, with limited exceptions. The Privacy Act applies only to information sought from individuals and those who are United States citizens. Next slide. The Wells Notice. A Wells Notice is a letter from the Commission informing individuals or entities being investigated that the Commission intends to bring an enforcement action. The Wells Notice should provide notice that the Division is considering recommending or intends to recommend to the Commission a certain enforcement action, the potential violations at the heart of that recommendation, and the opportunity for the individual or entity to submit arguments or evidence to the Division of Enforcement and the Commission in opposition to any enforcement action. There's no legal requirement to provide Wells notice or to respond to such a notice. Next slide. A Wells submission. A Wells submission is a voluntary written statement to the SEC setting forth a party's factual and legal positions as to why further enforcement action is unwarranted, and it is a response to the Wells notice. Potential benefits include persuading the SEC staff not to recommend enforcement action, to recommend a more limited enforcement action, or to offer more favorable settlement terms. Potential dangers in making a Wells submission include discoverability in private civil suit, disclosure to the Department of Justice or another state or federal law enforcement or regulatory organization for use in a related proceeding, use as an admission of wrongdoing in a future SEC proceeding, and serving as a roadmap of a party's planned defense in future litigation. Next slide. Investigations cannot be closed until all enforcement actions in the case are complete. This requires a final judgment in federal court or a commission order. All monetary sanctions have been paid in full or excused by the commission. All sanctions collected have been either distributed to investors or paid into Treasury. Now, this is what's necessary when closing an investigation that has been filed. Let's look at what happens, next slide, where no investigation occurs or no enforcement action is recommended or brought. Investigations are closed when no enforcement action is recommended. Many different factors are considered when making a termination letter. The SEC's policy is to notify parties that investigations are closed by sending a termination letter. Termination letters are typically sent to anyone who is identified in the caption of a formal order, submitted or solicited to submit a Wells submission, who was asked for anyone who asked for a notice of termination, and any individual or entity that reasonably believes that the staff was considering recommending enforcement action against him or her. Closing an investigation does not mean that the party has been exonerated, that no action may ultimately be taken in the future. Next slide. Types of securities enforcement actions. Criminal enforcement actions by state and federal law enforcement authorities. There's civil enforcement actions brought by the SEC. The SEC may bring administrative proceedings and civil actions by private investors. The remedies available in SEC enforcement actions include a civil injunction, an order prohibiting the continuing and future violations of the federal securities laws, disgorgement, which is the repayment of monies obtained or losses avoided as a result of the wrongful conduct, monetary penalties above and beyond any disgorgement ordered, and a bar, an order prohibiting an individual from serving as an officer or director of a public company or participating in a penny stock offering. Next slide. Parallel proceedings. In securities cases, it's permissible for criminal, civil, and self-regulatory proceedings to occur simultaneously. Since the SEC it can only bring civil cases, there may be a need for criminal or self-regulatory proceedings to also occur. The SEC is authorized to refer cases to the Department of Justice for criminal prosecution and to assist prosecutors in those cases. Rule 2 of the Commission's rules relating to investigations permits SEC staff to discuss a non-public investigation with other governmental authorities. Enforcement staff may share its investigation files with the Department of Justice upon request. Enforcement staff may not take an SEC civil investigative action of any type in order to benefit a criminal investigation or prosecution. The SEC may also, and regularly does, refer cases to other organizations, including self-regulatory organizations like FINRA, Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which was established through SOX, to various state law enforcement and regulatory agencies, and to professional licensing boards. Next slide. Common questions. This is a good point for us to see if there's any questions from those listening in today. You know, I don't see any questions, so I will keep going. With the limited time, there's a question. We'll move on to slide. That says what constitutes a security. What I'd like you to take away from this presentation is that the definition of security is quite broad. It's beyond stocks and bonds. It can be almost anything that is significant, that involves money, that may involve the investment of monies. There's a definition that you'll see in your slides at slide 61, which gives a long list of things that constitute securities, and slide 62 provides a test for investment contract. These are things where there's an investment of money, a common enterprise, an expectation of profit solely from the efforts of others. This is a common thing that we see even in security, things that don't appear like securities. The next slide is, what is the international reach of the U.S. securities laws? From the whistleblower perspective, with few exclusions or qualifications, a whistleblower can be any individual or group of individuals, regardless of citizenship. Eligible securities violations may occur anywhere in the world. To determine whether the SEC has jurisdiction, I would encourage you to look at investors, investments, operations, employees, or clients in the U.S. Anytime you have some of those, there is a possibility of potential securities jurisdiction. Let's skip the next two slides and go to slide 61. What are the most common types of securities law violations? Next slide. And that would be market manipulation, offering fraud, financial fraud, insider trading, trading and pricing cases, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases, and municipal securities fraud cases. There's slides that we don't have time to cover today that go from 67 to 75 that will give a little bit more detailed definition of these various securities violations. Slide 76 states, what is the statute of limitations for bringing SEC enforcement action? The short answer is, for penalties, it is 5 years. However, the 5 years can be told with under different theories. You can see that in slides 77 and 78. For more information, you can find that in the handout. Now, a question commonly asked is, where can potential whistleblowers and other interested parties learn more about the securities laws and the SEC enforcement process? And the answer to that is, I strongly encourage you to go to the SECWhistlebloweradvocate.com website. This innovative website uses videos, searchable databases, eligibility calculators, comprehensive legal primers, comprehensive thought leadership collections, and timely blog entries to help responsible organizations to establish a culture of integrity and courageous whistleblowers to report possible securities violations. Next slide. Well, we're at the end of our presentation today. I encourage you to plug in to other webinars in the Whistleblowing in the Corporate World series, which will examine other aspects of corporate whistleblowing and its implications in various segments of the commercial marketplace. The program in our series, the next programs in our series will be Corporate Lawyers as Whistleblowers, followed by the final installment in the series, Whistleblowing and the Corporate Insider. Again, I thank you for participating in this program. At this time, I again welcome any questions that you may have. And you're always welcome to speak to me if you have questions about any of these topics.
Thank you for selecting West Legal Ed Center. For optimal savings, why not consider a customized subscription? You'll get unlimited access to the largest, most current CLE library offered online. Call 1-866-765-MCLE for more information on how to maximize this opportunity. That's 1-866-765-MCLE for continuing education that's always comprehensive, always relevant, always current.